Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Welcome to this session, Breaking News in the Age of Social Media. I'm delighted to welcome you to a conversation about breaking the news in the digital era, where a proliferation of platforms and devices have allowed everyone to imagine that they're citizen journalists, where facts are easily dismissed, and where there seems to be no obvious business model to ensure public interest journalism survives. According to a recent report by Pew Research, newsroom jobs have fallen by 23% in the past decade. Here, as in the rest of the English language market, every month brings another round of redundancies and layoffs. So joining us to help unravel the issues are Jill Abramson, Scott Mitchell and Marnie Cordell to reflect on the conundrums that face the media, both legacy and upstarts, as Jill Abramson calls them. Each of our guests is going to give us their reflections on these issues, and then we'll open up the conversation to you in the audience. So, we're living in dangerous times where the term post-truth has gained currency and legitimacy. Where there were once solid boundaries between editorial and marketing, they're now blurred. Where speed trumps, sorry, I should never use the word trump again. Where speed trumps accuracy every time. Where the standing of professional reporters has been tarnished. And where every bystander with an iPhone becomes their equal. And where what matters to the all-powerful media oligarchs are clicks and likes and page views. Our first speaker today is Jill Abramson, who, of course, has had a stellar career as a journalist, investigative reporter, and senior editor on most of the leading serious newspapers in the US. After years as the managing editor, in 2011, she was appointed as the executive editor of the New York Times, a role she held for 3 years. Her most recent book, which I recommend to you highly, Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts, analyses the trajectory of four media outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, BuzzFeed, and Vice. So given the interests of our other two guests and what they have, their interest in her critique, let's begin by giving the microphone to Jill. Jill Abramson, please join me.
Thank
welcome.
You. Here. When Louise just said in her introduction, you know, social media and breaking news, it is, of course, a double entendre that many people see social media as, you know, a malevolent force on serious, in-depth news. I don't have that view, but recently I got, you know, I upgraded my iPhone, and I just decided no Facebook app, no Twitter app, because I already have so much to read, you know, so much incoming news. And I was not a big contributor to Facebook. I barely ever posted. And, you know, I did not really tweet other than I wrote a political column for The Guardian, and I would, you know, do a link to that. But, you know, I just find it hard to really focus on anything. And it's hard to get, because of the way especially the news feed works, any sense of completing anything. So, and there's the aspect, you know, on Twitter, it's become such a sewer in many ways. I mean, just awful, you know, hate, messages of hate, let alone, you know, crazy conspiracy theories spreading through Twitter. And then, as Louise said, just, you know, real fake news, stories that are just completely wrong, but can get picked up and amplified because, you know, social media is the most powerful, you know, I'm trying to think, megaphone, it came to me, the most powerful megaphone society has ever known, you know, in its ability to spread and amplify messages as more and more people look at a piece of content and as news goes viral. And, you know, my book is a narrative. It's a story of the past decade of digital disruption and change, and social media is a very big character in it. And without social media platforms, especially Facebook, in the case of Marnie's BuzzFeed and Vice, where Scott once worked, BuzzFeed wouldn't have been able to launch itself without Facebook, and now custom makes, you know, stories for every social platform you can think of, even ones that do precious little news like Pinterest. And Vice could not have existed as a big video player without YouTube, which is of course owned by Google. And you know what social media platforms did, and its biggest effect, I think, on how people get their news is that it disaggregated the news report. There are very few people left, at least in the US, who actually like go to the homepage of a particular news organization and then stay on that site. 62% of adults get the news that they deign to pay attention to from their Facebook feeds. And Louise was talking about the decline in public trust for news providers. And, you know, friends and family are seen as a much more reliable source of what any of us might wanna read, much more than some editor sitting, you know, on the third floor of the New York Times building in New York. And you know, the two legacy newspapers that I write about, the Times and the Post, were surprisingly slow to understand that social media was actually part of the publishing process. It's like, at the Times, for most of my career there, we thought we hit a button, we published a story, it went online, and then it had impact or it didn't. And the newsroom has now caught up and, you know, has many, many editors who are devoted solely to social media. And even the Post, the Washington Post was slow, which is odd because Don Graham, you know, the Grahams owned the Washington Post for a long time, and Donald Graham was a big fan of Facebook. He met Zuckerberg right after he left Harvard and was just developing what was then called the Facebook. And Zuckerberg actually gave him a chance. He was, you know, trying to raise money at that point, and he was willing to give Graham, because he thought, you know, he was a really good advisor and would be value added, you know, 10% of Facebook for not a whole lot of money. And they had a handshake deal. And of course, a venture capital firm made a higher offer. And Zuckerberg was out to dinner with, you know, some of his Facebook colleagues, and he went upstairs to go to the men's room and didn't return. So one of his colleagues went into the bathroom and saw Zuckerberg crying on the floor because he was so sort of tortured that he was going to have to try to get out of the deal with Graham. But that turned out to be easy as pie. Graham was a gentleman, but if the Washington Post had had that 10% of Facebook, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have needed Jeff Bezos to come and rescue it. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
More? Okay.
We're only warming up, if you would like.
Yeah, I would like, I think that BuzzFeed, of all of the news organizations I write about, you know, and there are four who are the main characters, that BuzzFeed is the canniest and the most edgy about using social media. And, you know, it's because the founder of the company, Jonah Peretti, who I spent a lot of time with, sort of, believe it or not, invented virality. He was at graduate school at MIT, and he did early experiments in how information goes viral. And his first lesson in virality came when Nike was offering designer sneakers where you could request your own word to be on the sole. And Peretti, you know, wrote to filled out his order and asked that the word sweatshop be written on the sole of his shoe. And, you know, at various levels of the company, it was no, with one bullshit reason after another coming back to him. And, you know, he had, you know, maybe 10 or a dozen of these responses, and he thought they were funny. And so he just put this chain of emails about the sweatshop sneakers on the internet, and millions of people instantly read that chain of emails, and within 2 days, Jonah was invited onto the Today Show, which is our biggest audience morning news program. And, you know, then one of his tech smarty pants friends dared him, said, "You'll never be able to do that again." And with his sister, who is a pretty high-profile comedian named Chelsea Manning, he and his sister cooked up a dateline where you could basically digitally break up with either your boyfriend or girlfriend and, you know, not have to actually in person speak to them or write to them. And of course, boom, that went viral. And he just kept it up. And he was one of the founders of the Huffington Post. And when the Huffington Post was first sold to AOL, he had enough of, you know, a nest egg to start his own company based on how to make things go viral on social media.
Fascinating. Okay, we will drill down to the kind of challenges for traditional and upstart media later in this conversation. But let's hear now from Scott Mitchell. Scott is the digital lead of audio current affairs at the ABC. He was instrumental in establishing the ABC Life website, and some people may have a view about that, and has worked as a producer on the ABC TV program You Can't Ask That, and as a senior editor and editor, I understand from our conversation before, at Vice News. Scott.
Thank you. I would just say, I don't know if I was instrumental in the start of ABC Life. I'll give that credit to the wonderful Scott Spark and some of the deputy editors there, and Claudine Ryan, the editor-in-chief. But I should also mention that I'm speaking here as Scott Mitchell. My views are not those of the ABC, and if you have any complaints, please address them to the hotline. So, listen, you know, we're going to obviously talk about a lot of the challenges of social media, a lot of the things that are sort of, you know, very dangerous and things that are very concerning for news organisations. But I did want to start with something that I'm quite optimistic about. And, you know, some colleagues may not share this, but I certainly feel it. And that's about the role that people can play in the change that's happening in newsrooms via social media. You know, I think sometimes, you know, journalists can look at social media and it is a very aggressive place, you know, particularly obviously for female journalists who are high profile, particularly for people of colour. There can be a lot of negativity on social media, but there are also some forces that I think have been hugely transformative and will continue to be transformative for newsrooms and opening up. One really obvious example I just really thought I'd start off with is Fixed It. Has anyone heard of Fixed It, the hashtag? So this is started by Jane Gilmore, and it's going around and looking at headlines that have talked about violence against women, about sexual assault, and looking at the way people cover those stories and how media has not had always a great track record of talking about that stuff and has used language that is sometimes sexualized, sometimes does not assign blame where it should be assigned. One of the most remarkable ones she did was this headline. Woman was flirty and very friendly in the hours before she was allegedly raped. And Jane fixed that to man accused of rape says alleged victim chatted to people at a party. Now, she created that, but obviously so many other women have used that hashtag to correct the way that we talk about these things. And it's been going for about 4 years now. Jane Gilmore has a book that's coming out later this year that I would, you know, give a quick plug to. But, you know, Jane is not just a punter, you know, she is a writer. A lot of the people who have used that hashtags are academics. They are people who know what they are talking about. And just because that conversation takes place on Twitter doesn't mean that we should dismiss it as these are keyboard warriors, these are people who don't know what they're talking about, they're not journalists. And it's taken time, but that conversation has led to real change in newsrooms and discussions among colleagues, notes on, you know, guidance notes on how we're going to deal with these things across all kinds of news organizations. That's a really simple, obvious one, but I think, you know, another that is harder for me to quantify and give examples specifically of is what has happened after Christchurch. And the conversations about how newsrooms deal with the far right after Charlottesville, after Christchurch, are really, really important. We need to think about when we engage with white supremacy, how we talk about that. When do we talk about it? And when we do, how do we ask those questions? And that conversation would not be happening in newsrooms if it was not for people outside newsrooms talking about it. It wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for young journalists, young Muslim journalists, young people of color who are writing about that. And to dismiss them as keyboard warriors, you know, these are professionals, these are academics, these are journalists, these are people who know what they are talking about. And, you know, I'm not saying that these people online saying these things should dictate newsroom policy, but if we're a press that seeks to engage with civil society, we need to hear that feedback. And as you know, colleagues, we need to talk to each other and figure out how to do better. And also on a personal note, to just round this off, I produced a series on the ABC. I was a producer of a series called You Can't Ask That. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. That's very kind. But we, you know, we've had guests on that show who have gone on to, after the show, become very big on social media. Two of them, Carly Findlay and Nicole Lee, often talk about disability representation in the media online. They talk a lot about it, and sometimes they criticize news organizations, including the ABC sometimes. And at a personal level, taking out kind of analysis of social media for a second, I don't know how I can help line up those interviews, help talk to those people, and ask them to talk about the most vulnerable things that have ever happened in their lives and share those experiences. And then when those people, as citizens, want to engage with the Fourth Estate and criticize it and engage, that I can dismiss them. And I think journalists need to be aware that time and time again, we are asking people to share their most vulnerable experiences, and that we, when they turn around and they say, you haven't done a good job here, you haven't done a good job of covering this issue down the line, we have to listen. We're obliged to listen. We're not obliged to always agree. And, you know, certainly Twitter gets things wrong sometimes. People get things wrong. They come after the wrong people. But we're definitely obliged to listen. We must listen to those people. If we cannot tell those stories and then not. And, you know, absolutely when it's, you know, obviously like colleagues in the newsroom, now who may have lived that experience and can put their hand up, and we should be listening and supporting them. So, look, I just sort of, before we get into all the things that it's doing to the marketplace of news, wanted to say that I do think there's a really positive thing that social media can do in the way that newsrooms are changing and becoming better and better and better, I hope, at telling stories. And, you know, everyone here is a part of that conversation. And I wouldn't want to be a part of a profession and a news media that, that completely shuts that dialogue down. Anyway, that's me.
Thank you. And our final speaker today is Marnie Cordell. She's the head of news at BuzzFeed. She was the editor and owner of New Matilda before taking over as editor of Crikey. So she's worked in the independent media for more than a decade and has experience both in traditional print media and in developing online news sites. Marnie.
Thank you, Louise. Yeah, so I feel like we've been having this conversation for about 20 years, but I tried to come up with something unique to say today, so I hope I have. Obviously, there is the question about models of supporting quality reporting on the internet. I think that's probably more interesting to journalists than it is to ordinary readers. So I'm going to skip that part and go straight to what I think is a more interesting question, and that's how to have impact with your journalism now. Because what social media has done is drastically shortened our attention spans. And now that we also have phones in our pockets, news feeds in our pockets, even more so. People are scrolling content, people are hungry for content, but keeping their attention is the challenge that editors are facing in this environment. So social media is obviously a huge part of what we do at BuzzFeed. As Jill pointed out, it is intrinsic to our business model. And it is an incredible distribution model. I think it's had a really positive impact on news reaching bigger audiences and unexpected audiences. But when it works really well. So great investigative journalism can reach millions of people. It can have real-world impact, and it can bring down corrupt governments. But I think the downside of it is that ability to capture people's attention and sustain their attention, and also potentially have impact in the real world. I think social media in some ways has made us quite dissatisfied with reality. I also think the rise of the kind of content that pulls at your heartstrings has had that impact as well. There's that McSweeney's article that's, what was it called? Sorry, Kid, but the amount of cute animal content I've mainlined has numbed me to even the most adorable content. And I do feel like in some ways that's what we're dealing with when we're trying to get people to care about big stories. So that's why you see people see the media framing stories in ever more attention-grabbing ways. And on the one end of that spectrum, you have clickbait, which is literally just getting people to click. Clickbait is essentially useless in this current environment unless you're being paid per click. There's no point disappointing your audience, because clickbait is, you click on it, you're usually disappointed with the substance of the article because it doesn't live up to the overhyped headline, and then you click away. But on the other end of this spectrum, you have this question of how to not only get someone to click, but how to sustain their attention and interest and potentially get them to care or even to act. And to me, that's the more interesting challenge in this faster-paced news environment. So I would hold up the issue of climate change as a very good example. I think in the media we get a lot of criticism. Why don't we cover climate change more? Why don't we make it an election issue? Why haven't we put it on the agenda? And if you go to editors, any editor working in online media, and ask them what their worst stats are, their worst reader stats, I guarantee you that most of them are on stories about climate change. People just don't read them, which seems alarming, given its, the potential downfall of humanity. People don't seem to want to read about it. But when you ask audiences what they care about, conversely, which is also strange, they will tell you that 90% of them will tell you that climate change is really important to them. But solving this issue of getting people to engage with serious issues when they've got news feeds to scroll through is the challenge today. So I guess the challenges are competing in a noisy online environment, how to build a loyal audience to keep their and keep their attention, and how to make people care. So at BuzzFeed, obviously we have a small newsroom, a tiny newsroom now. We've had a recent round of redundancies. The way that I've tried to address that is to actually go narrow. So we specialise. We have beat reporters who only cover particular topics. And as an example, I don't have anyone on the campaign buses during the election campaign. Instead, I've sent my beat reporters on very specific in-depth stories. So Lane, saying to you, I think he's here today, has recently come back from the Kimberley, covering a story on suicide among young Aboriginal people there. I have another reporter who's just flown to the Northern Territory to cover a story about lead in drinking water in a remote community. Our readers are predominantly young and female, so that is top of mind, which is unusual as well. I've never worked anywhere where that's the case. So that's top of mind in all our editorial decisions. We cover rental stress, which is a huge one for young people. We've done a lot on welfare, higher education, casual work, wage theft. Health is a big one. I have one reporter, Gina Rushton, who focuses solely on gender and women's issues, and she's covered the push to get abortion out of the Crimes Act. We have these tools now where we can analyse our audiences right down to minute detail and do much more targeted journalism. So I guess what I see as the answer to these shrinking newsrooms is doing what you do well, and leaving the rest to AOP.
That's a nice model, very efficient model. And so there's lots of questions that come up out of what you've all said. I wondered, though, whether you felt that increasingly the prison through which to attract readers is through, and it goes to something Scott said, is the personal story, and whether you think, we're talking specifically here about breaking news, whether we haven't got we're not saturated. I mean, maybe I'm just, sort of cynical or sort of sick of the personal story and want some information, some analysis and some facts and some expertise, and that actually we don't feel like we can talk about climate change. We don't really care about, the region we live in unless it comes through the prism of someone's personal experience. It has to expand out from the personal narrative. And I don't know how you feel about that in terms of the challenge of breaking news, which is a particular, part of the newsroom. Jill, I don't know whether you have a sense of that.
I think that there's a huge appetite for breaking news. Mm. And, a news organization that doesn't is going to be in trouble in terms of expanding readership. We live in a world now where people want to know what happened the instant it happens.
Yes.
And that's where Twitter, has become, an alarm system for everybody. And
but isn't the kind of what you can overlay on it, sorry to interrupt, but what you can overlay on that, the capacity on your phone to register that, Paul Keating called, and did he call Scott Morrison a fossil in a baseball cap, I think. I can't remember what he said at the, after the launch in Brisbane. But you can get that on your phone. But what you want from a good editorial and, mind is some analysis of that and some,
right.
You don't just, it's easy to get that bit of information, but what you want is something that enriches that information, no? And isn't that the aspiration or the kind of, mandate for all of you in your different...
It's why the New York Times has stayed alive and expanded the number of readers it has, both online and in print.
You also had Trump. You had the misfortune and the
fortune. Well, I was just going to say, that as long as Trump is in the headline in the U.S., the story is going to be clicked on and read, which is why, on any news app of a big American news organization like CNN or The Times, you will see sometimes you have to scroll down, two screens worth before you encounter anything that isn't Trump. And the fact that those stories, attract a lot of clicks and a big readership, it has this psychological effect. I know inside the Times newsroom, because a colleague of mine at the Times told me that, you know, he writes a weekly analysis column, and, you know, he often wants to write about other things, but when he does, the story isn't one of the most read stories. And now everyone in every newsroom has the analytics, so they know exactly who's reading what story in what minute, who's completing the story. And, you know, at BuzzFeed pioneered something that everyone does now, which is A-B testing of headlines. They sometimes, you know, especially on a long story, because it's hard to track readers to those, they can have as many as a dozen headlines that they play around with to get the best one, and that's smart. But
it's also distorting. Isn't it? It doesn't affect, I wonder if, you know.
Well, if it's a good story, I want it to get the most readers it can. And, you know, if it has to then have a slightly clickbaity headline.
But all
so
the metrics. But the metrics
but,
that you
but
have.
But all newsrooms are metrics crazy. And, you know, one of the anecdotes in Merchants of Truth is about a Washington Post reporter who spent most of his sessions with his psychiatrist talking about his neurosis about Chartbeat, which is one of the big analytics companies that news organizations pay to, you know, keep up with what everyone is reading, that he was just all twisted up. And, you know, no one, you know, no matter how great your story on climate change is, you don't want it to not register anywhere. And that isn't just a matter of, you know, having a big audience and making money on advertising. It's sort of the psychology of newsrooms now. Metrics are baked in.
And it's not skewing? I question to all of you, you don't feel it's skewing your writers, not feeling your journalists, not feeling, well, I know that if I actually, you know, put that par here, or my audience responds when I write in the following way or have the following views, isn't that actually affecting the content? That actually you're no longer, you would say, I suppose, Scott, that it's a great thing to be in this relationship, so, you know, dynamic relationship with, you know, your reader and the people who are engaging with you. But actually, isn't it quite distorting in the end? Because actually you are driven by the metrics.
I think it has, I think it does change form, certainly. I think you do need to write in a specific way for online. You need to create video a certain way for online. And look, often that is, you know, front-loading the story. And, you know, I think in traditional print, if you had a killer quote, you might allow it to fall a bit further down, let a reader discover that nugget, whereas often in digital is such a front-loading of stories. But I don't think that doesn't distort... I don't think it distorts editorial choices as much as people would think. I think people are really worried that Chartbeat and those metrics that we have, which are really powerful tools, they're really, you know, they do interesting things. But I don't think it distorts editorial choices, and I think most people now, maybe in the early days it did, but now we're in a fairly mature digital media environment, and I think editors know that, you know, even with the best sell on a story, it may not, you know, have a great day. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't do the story. And we're in a much longer term game, I think, of growing and retaining audiences and getting them to engage deeply. And I don't know many editors who would say, well, we won't cover that again because it didn't do well today. Because you just don't know what would happen.
Traffic isn't everything, absolutely not. And engagement is a big one. So, but this question of whether the personal frame is doing damage to news, I don't personally think it is, because it actually allows you to reach a different audience with the news. If you frame something around this woman did X, Y, and Z, more people will click on it because they want relatable content, and that's what works on social media. But that doesn't mean that the story itself isn't exactly the same news story as it would be with a more boring headline.
It's not relatable. It's the term. I know. I sound like a complete reactionary. It's the thing relatable. You know.
Yeah, it's a catch-22.
It's a catch-22, isn't it? It's your kind of, and the anxiety, really, that, you know, the, you know, your friend who has to help on the couch with his therapist once a week, his analyst once a week, you know, it's kind of the anxiety around that it's not relatable, you know.
But that's the issue with climate change, because how do you make it relatable? Because it hasn't quite happened yet. I'm sure it will be very relatable at some point soon.
Relatable. So, Scott, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the one. So, as a book person, a print person, I think it's absolutely fabulous and inspiring that actually it's the online content that people are reading, that it's generating the audiences or enlarging the audiences for audio and visual content out of the ABC. I wondered if you could talk about that. I think it's a great thing.
Yeah,
but,
you know. Look, I'll try and keep it brief because I don't want to speak on behalf of the ABC.
No,
at
your
all.
Own experience.
But I can, I can absolutely say that, you know, like, I think, you know, it, very famously, the pivot to video didn't sort of come together, and that was largely because Facebook was essentially miscounting video views. People may know this, but, you know, 2 years ago, there was a huge move in newsrooms to pivot to video, and that still is paying dividends for a lot of media companies through YouTube and, you know, Vox Media working with Netflix and Vice going on to work with HBO and all kinds of other things. But, you know, text, I think, is still enormously, enormously important and is still, you know, for social, that's the thing you can consume immediately. That is the thing you can consume no matter where you are, wherever you are. And I think it's still, you know, hugely important. You're going to see, you know, newsrooms have almost shifted back after the pivot to video to, I think, really valuing and understanding that text is a huge part of the future.
Sorry to interrupt, but a basic fact is that video, because there can be those pre-roll ads before video, is, you know, a bigger moneymaker, you know, in terms of attracting more expensive advertising than a text story.
I think the thing is as well, like, I think what Louise is alluding to is that I think a lot of media companies, you need to have an ecosystem of content where no matter how somebody prefers to consume the story, they can get to the story somehow, and that story can be wherever they are spending their time on whatever platform. And that's impossible for all stories, but I think where possible, it's becoming very important to have an audio element to your offering, your daily offering, text element, video element, and that can draw people in and circulate and recirculate.
We're asking a lot of journalists, though, in that context, in this impoverished environment where, you know, the media are struggling, you know, as commercial operations, they're in dire straits and struggling, quite most of them. And you're asking a lot. I mean, I know that the experience I know best is the ABC. Is what you're asking of journalists in the ABC is to be everything. You know, their own cameraman, their own soundman, to write the story. I mean, you know this better than I do, Scott. But it seems to me a lot is being asked of the news journalists these days, and I wondered how all of you felt about that.
If I could briefly, I won't talk about the ABC, but my experience maybe at Vice a little bit, and my early experience at ABC on a show called Hungry Beast and things. You know, I think when we talk about new media and Vice News and BuzzFeed and these companies, I think, you know, a huge part of their the success that they've had is out of giving opportunity to younger people. I think when, you know, when there was a big contraction and fear among traditional media in like the mid-2000s, and, you know, a lot of cadet programs stopped taking people, a lot of career advancement opportunities dried up, and places like Vice News and BuzzFeed opened the doors and gave huge responsibility to younger people to create new forms of content.
And it's totally different for your generation. Like, you're 10 years younger than me, and you had opportunities that I never had at your age because of that. Yeah, totally.
I mean, you know, they're giving jobs in, you know, fairly senior roles, but they're not very well paid, but you could have responsibility. And that ladder really dried up, I think, at a lot of traditional news organizations because they couldn't bring on a new round of cadets. They couldn't, and because they were in the middle of digital transformation at the time, what do you get young people to do? You get them to upload the copy to the website, and they're not getting to do a lot of reporting. And so young people went to these organizations and, you know, could do incredible things, could create new styles of content. And, you know, it's not just you know, Shane Smith and Jonah Peretti are, you know, while, you know, big figures, you know, a lot of their success was built on the back of, you know, this, the most talented journalists of their generation who weren't getting anywhere in traditional companies and made the leap. And now, you know, with what's going on now, I mean, there's been disadvantages to it, to making that leap, and there's a security at some of the traditional players still, but it's a, yeah, I think, you know, young people's ability in this industry to kind of fuel this digital transformation is kind of sometimes overlooked. And they can, you know, people are doing incredible things. And, you know, you look at people seem to think that kind of seniority and older journalists are really where trustworthiness is developed, and that, you know, you shouldn't have your shot until you've got that. But I look at, you know, Richard Carlton and Mike Willacy were hosting Stay Tonight on the ABC when they were like 25 years old. Where's that happening today? Not many places, anyway.
But there is a kind of process of training, isn't there? I'm not sort of saying, I mean, I think, you know, there's opportunities need to be opened up, of course. I mean, you know, it's not a kind of, you know, shouldn't be a generational, you know, struggle, yeah, for young people to wrest control and, you know, opportunity away from, you know, the those more mature individuals. But the craft of learning, and we're supposed to be talking about breaking news here, the craft that's involved in that, how you learn it, and I don't know whether in newsrooms today there's actually the capacity, given the tensions, given the obligations, given the pressures that they're under, how, you know, incoming, up the next generation of investigative journalists learns their craft. I mean, I watch people like Nick McKenzie and, you know, his colleagues at Fairfax who kind of break news stories, or, you know, routinely seem to do that. Where's the next generation? How do they learn this craft? It seems to me it's...
Marnie's trained a whole bunch of them.
I teach them all.
You teach them all? Oh, well, they're in very safe hands. Very
Scott's
safe
my
hands.
Former intern, so...
They're all your former interns.
No, but, Scott is. No, oh. But I think what Scott's saying is the young people basically know how to use all the tech programs you need. So you can either hire older journalists...
But it's not the technical
stuff.
But
what I'm saying is you can hire an older journalist with the journalistic skills and teach them the tech skills, or you can hire younger people who know how to do all of that and teach them the journalism skills. And I think that's my model. Teach them journalism.
So I think you're a little fixated, you... here we go, on the pipes and the platforms and the devices. And I think that's not...
No, but your question was, are we asking too much of journalists?
And no, I think how do they learn to be investigative journalists? How do they learn how to break
news? The question
news?
Before that was about whether you're asking too much. And I think the answer to that is no, because actually young people are very comfortable doing that and
Jill?
Don't feel like it's too much.
I was, you know, I have no reason in particular to tout BuzzFeed, but a surprising fact is they have as big an investigative unit as the Times does. And, you know, they were a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize a year ago for a big investigation they did of the murders of Russian oligarchs in London, which it was spectacular work. And Scott's right that, you know, what's different about their investigative unit is it's full of young reporters who have done good investigations at other places and are scooped up and are trained well. It's the hardest, the most expensive, you know, and
the most important.
Time-consuming, but it's absolutely the most important. You know, I spent much of my own career as an investigative journalist, and, you know, the U.S. Constitution protects the press because, you know, the founders of our country, you know, they were deathly afraid of over-centralized power, and they saw the press as a bulwark against that, that they would hold power accountable. And investigative journalism is necessary for that, and reporters have to be given time to dig and dig and dig and maybe hit some dry holes in the process. And, you know, what scares me in the U.S. is just, you know, local newspapers, which used to do this work and do big investigations of state government or local government, they're not. There are, you know, government organizations like city councils and state capitals that are not covered at all. And it's a really big problem. But, you know, to be on the optimism side, we're starting to see some really good all-digital local operations. There's a great one in Texas called the Texas Tribune, and you know there are quite a few. Not enough to fill the gap that's there, but it's good.
So there's been, I think it was in the Financial Review magazine, story about Judith Nielsen that had been, you know, published elsewhere, and who's put $100 million into an institute for journalism and ideas. And there was a count of the second story, the story afterward was about Eric Beecher rejecting the idea that philanthropy can keep, you know, investigative journalism, you know, robust independent journalism alive, and that it really we need to find a commercial model, a business model for this. And I just wondered, my last question to all of you before I open it up to the audience.
What the business model?
Well, if you would like to do that, we'll all take notes. Tell us the business model, Jill, but, you know, what do you think?
There isn't one that fits everybody. But, you know, in the investigative arena, there's an organization that I'm on the board of called ProPublica, which probably does the best investigative reporting anywhere. And they sometimes will partner with, you know, newspapers that can't afford to do it anymore. So I actually think nonprofit and reader revenue is a very promising area because, you know, digital advertising is completely unstable, and, you know, most digital startups in news were 100% ad-supported, but at this point, Facebook and Google are gobbling up 90% of the new digital ads. Yep. So you have to have another stream of revenue. And The Guardian, you know, just announced that they, you know, have finally broken even, and they asked their readers to contribute. And, you know, I think
if, and we did.
And I think people now will pay, but you have to be publishing things of singular quality that can't be found for free in a million other places. And that's hard because many news organizations in this hard financial landscape have stripped themselves down so much that they're not doing that much that people will pay for.
Scott, yesterday...
You've got a great model.
Yeah, we've got a great model at the ABC.
I think you're probably the best.
But, yeah, it's got a great model that's buffeted by, you know, the government of the day. It sort of, you know, gives with one hand and takes with the other and smacks you down while they're doing it.
I won't make any comment on that.
Oh, come on, Scott, it's just us. Come on, let rip.
Look, I'll be brief. I mean, if any of us had an idea of a model, I think we... wouldn't necessarily be sitting here, but I think you know, like it's obvious that places that have been funded with private equity, which you know does buttress you against having to make those regular returns, but ultimately you know comes with some strings
and impatience,
and you know it's very hard to go to private equity and ask them for more money to kind of secure your existing workforce. They want you to promise the...
Growth.
Growth or the kind of the firming up of a revenue model or whatever it is. So I think that's a really difficult place to be. And I think then, you know, I'll be very interested to see where some of that lands. But yeah, certainly I think some of the trust models are really interesting, and we'll see what happens with The Guardian, ProPublica and others, and supporter models are really interesting. But yeah, look, I'm not sure. I'll let Marnie carry things on there.
Oh, I don't have an answer. I've been involved in a lot of different models. And New Matilda had a similar model to The Guardian, which was people pay, but there was no paywall. It worked to an extent. I prefer having a salary to running a business. I think the model changes, and I think all of these sort of articles that you read, when there's a round of redundancies at BuzzFeed, for example, BuzzFeed's going under, everything's falling apart. It's not true. I mean, businesses go through these stages where there are some years are good, some years are bad. The Guardian a couple of years ago was having a bad year. So yeah, I think there is no one model that is going to fix everything, unfortunately. And when you work in the media, you expect it to be, there are redundancies. That's what happens, unfortunately. It's the industry that we're in.
Well, we've got three survivors and we're very privileged to have had three survivors here. Let me open it up to questions from the audience, and there are microphones here. We'll take one here first, please. And if we've only got 8 minutes left according to the clock, so if we can be brief in the questions, we'll have...
Hi. You started the session by talking about how a person with an iPhone is equivalent to a professional journalist, but of course that's a misnomer, because there is no such thing as a professional journalist, because journalism is not a profession, it's an occupation. I'm just wondering, is it time to actually professionalise journalism by imposing minimum standards and an externally regulated code of ethics? So is the model for saving journalism to make the word journalism finally mean something?
Oh, I think it's a profession. I think we've got the press council here. More teeth, less teeth. Anyway, keep going.
I mean, yeah, there is... there are ethics guidelines that, yeah, absolutely, they are guidelines. Look, I'm very reticent about that because I think it would bar out people who are less advantaged, particularly when we're talking about foreign journalism, in terms of people in, you know, developing countries where there is not a university system to pump out. You know, journalists. I think protecting, saying you are a journalist if you have done this qualification, you are not a journalist if you haven't, puts up barriers to access to the industry. And, you know, I do think that somebody in a village in northern Myanmar should be able to be a journalist if they can document everything and they can get sources and they can nail down their story. I think the most important thing is editorial rigor, not necessarily... saying this person is a journalist, this person isn't a journalist.
Hi, I'm a journalism student in New York doing my semester abroad here. And as a journalist in the making, I like to think, I ask you today, where do you see journalism going? It's internships are hard. It's, we feel, my generation, it's the most competitive it's ever been. So with social media, with the current state of journalism, where do you see it going?
Marnie, go on.
I think we'll have more of the same. Actually, as I was saying to Scott, I actually think your generation is a much better position than my generation was. Like, I was the generation where there were four cadetships at the paper. There are so many more opportunities available to you now, and I think take them, and they're exciting.
I've been in the industry 10 years, and like 8 weeks ago, I got my first full-time job. I've been on contracts for 10 years. So like, I've been very lucky. I've been so fortunate. I've gotten to work on amazing programs with amazing people. But there's no doubt that it's chaotic, and that can be really difficult. So that chaos isn't changing anytime soon, unfortunately. But I do think, you know, the silver lining is definitely what Marnie is saying, in terms of we're able to, you know, there's so much more access to being able to publish and get a byline on something today than when it was just those... you know, your city's local paper, or that, you know, if you were lucky to.
And you can't depend on having a career at one place, you know, for most of your working life. When I first went to work at the Wall Street Journal, I mean, most of the people in their Washington bureau where I was doing my investigative reporting had been there since they were clerks. And, you know, never expected to leave. And, you know, when I first joined the Times, there were quite a few of those same types. But by the time I wasn't there anymore, it was, you know, coming and going, hard to, you know, keep track of all the moves. And so I think you have to, you know, be willing to not look at a job you love as a secure lifetime career. But, you know, I do fundamentally believe that there's a human need for great storytelling, and that's just never going to go away. It may change shape and form and platform, but it's still, you know, the story that in print you can't put down that seems to still, even when it's long, attract people. So keep faith.
Keep faith, keep courage. And there was another question I missed. I'm sorry, over there, wherever, where, here, there.
Oh, hello.
There. Sorry, I'm so sorry.
I think my question's probably not bad segue from what you just commented on, Jill. I read a lot. I'm not a journalist. I'm a lawyer, and I read a lot. And I wanted to ask you something, and to find out whether my behaviour is necessarily representative of something that you're starting to see. I noticed I do have a Facebook account, but I use it largely as a news feed. And what I've found recently in my own behaviour is that I just can't cope with the tsunami of live feeds all the time from various social media sources. And what I've found myself doing more and more is reverting to subscribing to...
print?
Yes.
Yes.
The New York Times in Australia. I subscribe now to the Saturday paper. I donate to The Guardian, and I think it's important for me to do that. Because what I am finding is that, I mean, and the example that I can think of is in the last week when I was looking at all the live feeds of what was going on in Venezuela. And my connection to Venezuela is an old friend who's from Venezuela, and that's about it. Otherwise, it has no real direct bearing on my life, other than seeing what's happening in a former democracy or whatever that's slowly falling apart. And what I found is that I just couldn't handle all these one-liners coming through. And then what I did do is turn to the New York Times and find a fantastic article about what is happening in Venezuela, why is it happening, and why does it matter? And suddenly I had this analysis that I've been, you know, that I needed to contextualise what I was reading, and which I had to stop reading. And so my question is this, sorry, apologies.
It's all right. We've got 1 minute left.
Are you noticing at all a tipping point where that's starting to happen, wherein, given that you have access to these data analytics?
Thank you for the question, yes.
Yes, there's a niche of people who are, you know, love print and love serendipitous reading. You know, you see something on the page and read it and you don't know why, but so you absorb more of the news report. And, you know, but print is in decline, and it just is. And it's, as long as it, at least for a place like the Times, where print for so long, you know, really until 2015 maybe, was the biggest revenue source. You know, it's, as long as it goes sort of down like that, it's going to be okay. But in an economic downturn, having home delivery print subscriptions is expensive, and it could go like this, and that would be bad, because, you know, it's true that, you know, digital dimes are print dollars, or even $5 at this point.
Yeah. Scott and Marnie, and
I think the digital equivalent of that is people visiting your homepage to read like a curated offering, right? Mm-hmm. And for BuzzFeed, no. Like, our distribution is mostly through social media, but Scott was saying earlier that the ABC's, most of their traffic comes through the homepage still.
Which is really, really unusual. Like, there's not many places, and that's because the ABC is really lucky to be, you know, the most trusted brand in Australia. And so people still come to the homepage, and whether or not you're an ABC reader or wherever, I'd say, you know, go to the homepage. It's a, like, and no one does it, but like, that you might find something there, and it might be less aggressive than like your news feed, which can be, yeah, I agree, it can be overwhelming.
Or you could be a fossil like I am, who gets all the newspapers on my iPad and downloads, I suppose that's the expression, the facsimile of the actual paper. And I think, when am I going to change to reading, you know, the story line by line? But I'm
never
still
changed,
holding on to the idea, even if it's on the iPad. It's this actual newspaper, you know, it's so nice. And, you know, I can pick here and pick there. Anyway, enough. It's been a joy and a pleasure and very interesting to have a conversation with Jill Abramson, Scott Mitchell and Marnie Cordell and the audience. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.